For centuries, Africa's been plundered by foreign powers who've seized territory and reaped the benefits of profitable trade routes. In spite of Africa's abundant natural resources, it remains the poorest continent. The International Monetary Fund was formed in 1945 in the aftermath of the Great Depression and the Second World War as part of a new global financial order that was meant to promote sustainable economic growth and reduce poverty. It reports on its members' economic health and acts as a lender of last resort for countries facing financial crises. But according to the United Nations, more than half of the world's poor, 54.8% last year, live in African countries. So are global financial systems failing the continent? A new report by the IMF supports an African Union initiative to remove trade barriers to increase the flow of goods between African nations. It says the African Continental Free Trade Area could reduce extreme poverty. We caught up with the IMF's managing director while she was in Nairobi to endorse the AU initiative. Kristalina Georgieva talks to Al Jazeera. The managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you for having me.
So you're here visiting Kenya's capital, Nairobi, to launch a paper about trade between African countries, which says that if intra-African trade can be boosted, then up to 50 million people in this continent could be lifted out of poverty. But this comes at a time when the world is suffering from economic shocks, COVID-19, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and those who are hit hardest are here in Africa, economies and people. What is it that you're going to be saying to policymakers and others on this trip to try and make those gains from trade become a realistic outcome?
Exactly, because the global economic environment is challenging and that affects Africa significantly, policymakers need to unleash the potential of trade. We know that global growth is slowing down. African growth is slowing down. It was 4.8% in 21, went down to 3.9%. This year it would be 3.6%. And Africa needs to grow twice as fast to meet the aspiration of its people. Trade has proven to be a great instrument to create jobs, opportunities, and increase incomes. And Africa has a long way to go to fully benefit from the potential of trade. If tariff and non-tariff barriers are removed, if logistics and transportation are eased, the intracontinental trade can increase by 53%. Trade with the rest of the world can increase by 15%. Just imagine how many new jobs would be there as a result. Real per capita income can go up by 10%. It would be amazing to bring to force the full potential of the African Continental Free Trade Area. And now, exactly because growth is anemic, now is the time to do it.
It seems there are some big ifs in your answer and in the report. The reality, at many of these borders, which we travel to often for our work, is of course informal trade eclipses. Mm-hmm. The formal sector is very normal for people who want to take goods across borders or through airports or through seaports to pay bribes. Yep. This is not going to governments. That's something that's recognized in the report. And then governments who, of course, depending on income and revenue from tariffs, and then also depending for political power on pyramids of patronage, within which lie the officials who are collecting this money. And what's been signed at the African Union in Addis Ababa and the intentions expressed to remove these tariff and non-tariff barriers seem a far cry from the reality on the ground, and the political realities of many of these governments mean it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to achieve some of these things. I mean, is it realistic?
I agree with you. It is very difficult. Where we are today, there are so many obstacles, and so much of the dynamism in trade happens informally. We can't even measure exactly how much is being traded across borders informally. But I believe very strongly that a crisis is an opportunity, and that if you are to be determined to do well for your people, you have to pursue their dream. Their dream is for good jobs, good opportunities. 2 points we are communicating in this paper and more broadly. The first one is that Africa can take the lessons of others, especially ASEAN. Very dynamic, outperforming during this crisis the rest of the world. They brought tariffs down to 1% among themselves. Here, 6%. So there is 5% to shrink to create a better incentive for trade. Two, yes, governments rely on these tariffs for revenues, but they have ample space to increase taxation and improve collection of taxes. Even here in Kenya, the revenues are around 70%, slightly over 70% of GDP. They can go up, and on that basis, you can then trim down the revenues you collect from trade. Doesn't have to be that your revenues shrink. The main message I have and our institution has to Africa is you learned from COVID an important lesson that countries with strong fundamentals, like people with strong immune systems, withstand the shock of COVID much better. Build those fundamentals. And part of this building is the foundation for trade to be a stronger driver for growth.
It seems there are a significant number of countries, low-income countries in the world, including here in Africa, that didn't withstand the shock of COVID or the subsequent shock of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which, of course, has made money borrowed during COVID has become very expensive. The debts have become very expensive. And I think the IMF has helped out, what, more than 20 countries in Africa in the last couple of years. And one of the things you've spoken about recently is the possibility of if multiple low-income countries default, that this could cause a global debt crisis. What's the risk of that now?
Let me first express my very strong empathy for Africa, as well as for other parts of the world that are innocent bystanders. They are hit by COVID more severely because their capacity to respond, their fiscal space to respond is narrower. They're hit by Russia's invasion of Ukraine through high prices, inflation, and they're hit by high interest rates and strong dollar that translates into higher debt service. Exactly for this reason, because many of them have put their house in order, and yet they're being hit. The fund has very substantially increased engagement with Africa. Over the last year since COVID, we have provided $50 billion through special drawing rights allocation, which does not increase debt, and through programs. Actually, almost all African countries, one way or another, benefited from fund support. Right now, we have 21 programs with African countries, many more requests coming. And we do concentrate a lot of attention on the countries that are under higher burden of debt, because that puts them in a much weaker position. We have asked for debt service suspension when COVID started. We have pressed for the common framework for debt resolution. The G20 adopted. And while slow, it is producing some results. Chad resolved, Ghana on its way to be resolved, and I am positive about Zambia, Ethiopia coming next. We have to stay the course, because if we don't, there are 19 countries out of the 35 low-income countries in Africa that are either at debt distress, those four are there, or are near debt distress. And if we don't have a resolution pathway, yes, we can accumulate a bigger problem that can then affect the rest of the world.
What are you doing to try and get China or the big banks or others to be transparent about the money that they've lent?
Well, the accumulation of debt and changing landscape with number of countries now not able to serve is the most important incentive to all creditors to move in a coordinated manner to debt resolution. Because if they don't, creditors also get burned. They get affected by the fact that countries cannot service their obligations. It is complex, but I am encouraged by what we have experienced so far with the Sovereign Debt Roundtable, because the participation both of China and private sector is very constructive. They actually do want to have some principles on which resolution is being done. They're particularly concerned about comparability of treatment, and this is a topic we are focusing on. We want to have an agreement of how this is going to be pursued by our annual meetings in October. We are also working with China on debt reporting, because within the country, there are so many lenders, development banks, Exim Bank, the state-owned enterprises, that China itself doesn't quite yet have a full handle on how much has been provided as loans. I have no illusion that this would be a taxing process, but what is the alternative? The alternative is countries suffering with protracted and inefficient debt resolution. It would be a bumpy road, but a road that leads to a better debt resolution.
There's been some criticism of the programs that have been introduced to help countries in debt distress since COVID. Oxfam published a paper last month, and according to their research, for every $1 the IMF encouraged a set of poor countries to spend on public goods, it has told them to cut four times as much through austerity measures. So what Oxfam's arguing is that they're saying what you've called social spending floors, which are conditions in the loans which are meant to protect social spending for health, education and so on. They're saying that these have proved largely powerless against the IMF's own austerity policies, which oblige countries to cut public spending. So what they're arguing, I think, is as much as there's a good intention to try and protect the these, you know, essential public services, that that's still getting crushed and destroyed by the obligation of these countries to, in the end of the day, cut expenditure.
So I respectfully disagree. I have a high opinion of Oxfam. I like the fact that they're pushing us to do better. But when you look at our programs, you need to remember that what we lent is only a small fraction of what we mobilize as program support. So we should not be measuring what we do on the basis of the IMF loan. We should look at what does that loan do to bring more financing from other partners who would have not been there in the absence of this anchor that the IMF program provides. And two, it has to take into account the way in which we define the objectives of the program. And yes, we do work to protect social spending, especially education, health, and social protection. a very big part of IMF programs is directed not to the people who are vulnerable, but to make sure that the wealthy contribute more. We demand taxation to go up for the higher income and for taxes to be collected.
Oxfam say that the IMF's not doing that enough, and that it should, for example, put the pressure that's put on governments to, for example, cut subsidies. The same kind of pressure could be put on governments to introduce redistributive policies or taxes or other such measures.
I agree we can do more. And we do the analytical work in advance, so we can do more. We have been very clear that there has to be progressivity in taxation. And we are translating this into our programs. But let me be also very frank on subsidies. We are being criticized for advising governments. By the way, we are not demanding governments. Governments have to take it, to own it, to do it. We are advising them to eliminate harmful subsidies and translate fraction of the money, a good portion of the money, into support for low-income people. Why? Because who is the biggest beneficiary of fuel subsidies? The rich. Who drives big cars on long trips? It is the wealthy people. Why should the poor people in a country be subsidizing the rich? That is, I think Oxfam would agree with me that this is a very, very poor, poorly designed policy.
The IMF and the World Bank just 2 years ago agreed to reduce Sudan's debt by about $20 billion. How have the subsequent events, the coup and now the conflict, affected that program?
Certainly negatively. This is such a tragedy. The young people and the women of Sudan won that support. And now they are those that are losing because of the most recent developments. A conflict is always a terrible thing, but a conflict that crushes the newly found hopes of a nation, it is even more terrible, because it's like throwing cold water on these hopes. I have been following the engagement from the region, IGAD, President Ruto here. I really hope that there would be a pathway to restore a civilian government in Sudan. I'm also very concerned about potential spillovers. The visible spillover, people fleeing to other countries, already there. But we know from so many painful experiences that the invisible spillover, the trouble that travels and impacts negatively neighbors, is the one that we have to be concerned. So the sooner there is peace and then return to a democratic government, the better.
If we stand back for a minute and look at a sort of much bigger picture of how we ended up in this world today, which is so unequal. I mean, the ascendancy of the West has something that's gone on for about 500 years, 400 of which were, involved, or colonialism, slavery were involved in this massive accumulation of wealth in just a couple of parts of the world. And then it's only really within sort of the last 70 years or less that we've instead been talking about a different model, development, about poor countries borrowing from rich countries to try and grow and to try and equalize the situation. And with the exception of China, which has lifted millions of people out of poverty through industrialization, among the poorest countries in the global south, it would appear that this sort of relatively recent model hasn't worked. It hasn't redressed the imbalances of the past. Inequalities still growing. Africa's greatest exports are its commodities, its natural materials. And so the the whole system that was set up after the Second World War with the World Bank and with the IMF, which they're part of, and this whole system of rich countries lending money to poor countries to develop, is it working? Is it ever going to work?
Well, there are many more examples than just China. You travel around Asia, you go to Indonesia, you go to Vietnam, you go to India, and you see dynamism that is also lifting people out of poverty, creating broadly opportunities. You travel in Africa, you go to Senegal, you go to Cote d'Ivoire, you go to Rwanda. You see that there is prosperity being built on a more integrated global economy. I think the problem is that what is holding countries back more often than not is rule of law, insufficient governance, not up to par to the aspirations of people. And the result is policies just simply don't create an inclusive growth model. The very important lesson we learned at the fund is that if a program is not owned by the country, even if it technically achieves targets, it may not be sustained. And if a program is not promoting inclusivity, if it is not making the fabric of society stronger, not doing its job entirely.
Should rich countries and industrialized countries who benefited from and continue to benefit from using far more fossil fuels than everyone else and continuing to emit more carbon, should they pay for the damage that's done in poor countries, for example, Somalia, in this region, which is suffering a devastating drought for the worst in decades, you know, people are dying. Should the rich countries that benefited from this be picking up the bill?
They should be much more generous, yes. The fact that we are still not reaching the 100 billion a year is actually not a strong evidence of commitment to global public goods. We have developed at the IMF a way in which rich countries can help poor countries to adapt to climate change and move to a low carbon emission path. This is the Resilience and Sustainability Trust. So far, we have received pledges, and most of that pledges have already materialized, of $40 billion. This is using SDRs we allocated to rich countries that don't need it, to lend through the fund on concessional terms, long-term, to vulnerable low-income and middle-income countries. More of this needs to be done. I am very positive that we will prove that this instrument of structural transformation for a world living with the climate crisis is impactful, is effective, and then we would get more of our members to commit to it. Each and every one of us has to do its part and concentrate especially on those that have done nothing to create the problem of climate change but are most severely impacted by its consequences.
And on economic shocks, finally, what do you expect the rapidly growing area of artificial intelligence, which is changing the world before our very eyes, what's that going to do to the world economy?
We are not prepared. What is the employment opportunity we offer to people that are displaced by artificial intelligence? So there is a huge urgency for all of us, and actually at the fund this is something we are concentrating on, and I must admit I am sometimes waking up in the middle of the night thinking, can we really catch up? Can we think through? What does that mean? What does it mean for the financial system if we are to move to a world of artificial intelligence? So my appeal is to get the public sector, the leadership in countries and global leadership to be much more focused on understanding, projecting the implications of artificial intelligence and be able to put some guardrails before it is too late.
Kristalina Georgieva, the Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you.